week on Death of the Reader, Ken Hurd's changed my mind on who the culprit is. We'll talk about adapting murder mystery to stage with Andrew Fallon. And did Shakespeare have a hand in this mysterious romance?
You're listening to Death of the Reader, your murder mystery world tour on 2SER. We are Flex and Her, talking about chapters 7 to 14 of the Lerouge case by Emile Gaboriau. We have the arrest of a young man, the plight of a heartbroken magistrate, and a vampire.
A vampire?
You heard me correctly, a vampire.
I do not remember there being a vampire that factors into this story.
He has the darkened carriage. He has a mansion. He has a son who barely sees him. He is Count de Comorin.
Right.
A vampire.
Okay, I see what we're going to get here.
Is that not what you were picturing the entire time?
I guess I was.
Hunched over
his... I suppose.
Yes, my son, let me groom you. Yes, let me tell you about our family's dark secret. You are... And then he says, she's not my mother. He's like, yes, that was the secret all along.
I see, even though we've had it already revealed to us and it was entirely anticlimactic.
Yes.
I'm not going to be able to see the Viscount any other way now.
Yeah, as the son of a vampire.
Let's talk about the Lerouge case.
Yeah.
So this story, I think, has perhaps been the thematically most consistent going through of the books we've covered so far.
This is my kind of murder mystery novel, where the mystery is like not as important as just jamming it out with the characters, feeling their emotions, watching M. Deberon, his heartbreak, and the Count's trying to cover up his past lies. It's beautiful. This is my kind of drama.
Yeah, I think that a lot of the things that we said last week about this book are still true now.
Yeah.
Some of the other books we've covered have very much had a massive stylistic difference between the start and the end. This one doesn't seem to be going through much of a change.
No. It's firmly focused on this close circle, this core group of characters, which is excellent. And we're slowly unveiling the kind of the mystery of not just of the murder that we're experiencing, but of the aristocracy. One of my favorite parts of the book is how Emile, he's kind of poking fun at these well-to-do rich types. We had it a little bit with Juliet in the last chapter and the Marchioness. But again, with the Count, he complains that the poor people, the people with, you know, no money, the lower class, are the smart ones, you know. While we're sitting back earning X number of francs a year doing nothing, they're out there doing their work, doing their fair share. They're the smart ones for working and earning an income.
Definitely.
It's such a silly, like, rant that he goes on. And Albert in this chapter isn't really paying attention to it because he's thinking about, you know, the revelations that he's found. But yeah, I love the Count. I'm sorry, that must be apparent by now, but he's my favorite character in the book, I think. You know how we're a murder mystery world tour show, you know, we go around, it really feels like we're getting a French novel. Like, French Revolution is very much a core part of that culture and that history. And it's clear that it was, you know, in the mind of the author when he wrote this. Writing about how the aristocracy is seeing a decline, and in fact the kind of difference between the upper and lower classes starting to become, you know, less apparent, like the, you know, their income is going down and there's always concern about money and all that sort of thing. We very much see these older characters, the Marchioness and the Count, being humanized through this novel and also being made fun of, which I love it. I love it so much.
It does also fascinate me with that point made, that with so much turmoil going on politically,
yes,
in France at the time, the fact that the novel stays consistent, even though things probably would have changed politically between the release of the first chapter and the release of the last chapter,
probably,
as it was released episodically,
yeah,
it's really surprising and impressive that it manages to maintain as such a consistent tone.
Yeah, it's really good. I got to give a shout out to my boy Emile.
I think the one thing I did want to question you on there, though, was your mention of the closed circle.
Oh, yeah?
We've spoken a bit about locked rooms. We've spoken a bit about impossible crimes. But I will very much dispute the fact that this is a closed circle. For those of you unfamiliar with the concept, all it means is basically that we're dealing with a limited group of characters. We are absolutely not dealing with a limited group of characters here.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. In terms of solving the mystery, we are having more characters be introduced as we go on from chapter to chapter, and that's part of the serialized nature of it. I guess I was more thinking in terms of trying to solve the culprit, because that the concept of the closed circle, that there's, you know, this is 10 people on an island, and they're all trying to figure out who's killed everyone. It's going to be one of the 10 people, you know, that's what they're very, very Agatha Christie. this isn't quite that. We have a whole city to explore, and we even go outside of the city, or at least Tabaré does on his swift horse with his 12 apostles of the apocalypse that he just rides out with. But certainly in terms of finding the culprit, I think we should fall back on Knox's idea that the criminal should be introduced in the first five chapters or so of the novel. But yeah, you're right. We are very much going out and finding characters. I mean, we end chapter 14 with a note from Javert saying that he's found the man with the earrings, someone with the most valuable testimony. And apparently that's going to be relevant somehow. I don't know who you think that is, but hey, they could be like the most important witness in the entire case or something. Wouldn't
that
be crazy?
Maybe it could be. Maybe it could be. But he has been introduced at least when he does show up.
He has been mentioned.
I think that the thing with Knox's rules, which as always, there's a rundown on the podcast if you want to check that out.
Go check it out.
Is that when it says the culprit must be introduced in the early part of the story, it's saying that even if you don't have a closed circle, it should still be a closed circle.
Sure.
That even if everyone can move around and be free in theory, you should still have played it fair by the audience by keeping it within a certain scope.
Yeah.
But I do think that as a closing thought on that particular bubble, that this is an example of how you can do a not closed circle mystery while still being very distinct about who's in the bubble.
The suspect ellipses.
The partially opened circle.
Yeah, sure. The semicircle of culprits and suspects and such. Yeah, for sure.
I think the other thing that was particularly fascinating about what we were presented in chapters 7 to 14 was Albert's house.
Yeah, what about it? About his house. It's just fantastic. Like, that they're like, oh, Albert's gone. We can just seal off that wing and you can have another wing, Noel, all that stuff.
I just love that it's like, you know, I was talking last episode about how Noel came onto the scene and was just so immediately suspicious. And Albert was kind of lesser. But then this time around, we walk in and it's like, oh, it's the murder weapon that was described. Oh, yeah, it's a pair of muddy pants when the culprit arrived before it rained and then left after it rained.
Yeah, I mean, that's the fun thing about this novel is that they just give you the culprit right away. It's pretty handy, really. I wish more murder mysteries did that. They just give you all the evidence that you need to convict the first suspect that we're really given in the book.
I was already kind of suspicious of Albert given the kind of, you know, family mess that's going on.
It's great. It's very aristocracy. I love it.
But when we got to his house and just the foil was there, I was just like, oh, God, was I just completely wrong?
Although, to be fair, they can't find the tip, so who knows?
I mean,
well, the valet can't find the tip. Let's be specific here.
It doesn't seem to be that important.
Who knows?
Not to say anything about the previous story specifically, but this is perhaps the most distinct, like, story that we've had where the murder weapon has appeared as a clue.
Yeah, sure.
The ones we've covered so far, it's basically just been like, oh, yeah, here's the murder weapon.
I mean, it's a very specific weapon, right? Like, if we're talking about a foil, it is a fencing weapon. It can only be, you know, used by someone, or, you know, in the context of the story, it is going to be used by someone who fences. Fencing is like an athletic sport, so it's probably, you know, like, we get more clues out of it than just, it was a gun. Like, anyone can point a gun and pull the trigger.
Well, I actually want to kind of correct you on that a little bit, because I believe that this was still in the era where fencing was more of a honors duels kind of thing rather than just an athletic competition.
I suppose. So it's more about nobility then, sorry, I should say, than about athleticism.
Well, not only that, but I think that it also gives us a clue as to the motive in the very first chapter. The fact that it is a foil that Tabaré predicts is the weapon gives us a hint that this is a love-based motive.
I like that we get given a distinct murder weapon. It's the sort of thing you pick up a serialized, you know, murder novel, and then there's someone who keeps using, you know, the horn of a goat. He puts it on the victim's forehead after he's killed them, you know, and so we get to know, like, this is the person who used the horn of a goat and puts it on his victims, like a calling card.
I do think that in, you know, 19th century France, a foil may have been a bit more common than it is today.
Well, I think that's part of the fun as well of reading something from the, you know, the 19th century, is that we have records, but we don't live in that time. We don't know how it'd be.
I mean, I feel as though you've probably been a bit misled as to the commonality of, you know, fencing weapons when we have a stash of them in the corner of the studio here.
Oh my goodness, why are those there?
Well, we can get into that later when we once again reenact the crime.
Oh, no.
But I have to keep a stash of them on hand for when they come up as weapons.
I see, I see. You're a master fencer after all.
Coming up on the show, we'll be talking a bit more about those theories and what that little reenactment will do for us. But right now,
we have independent playwright, director, and more Andrew Fallon in to talk about the play-like elements of the LaRouche case and his upcoming production. Stick around.
You're listening to Death of the Reader on 2SER. This is Flex and Herds, and today we are joined by Mr. Andrew Fallon, published playwright of DDUSB, upcoming indie play producer, and self-proclaimed friend of the show. Here to shine a spotlight on the main act. What?
Self-proclaimed friend of the show?
That's what I said. Here to shine
How does
a spotlight.
That even work?
Here to shine a spotlight on the main act. The LaRouche case. How are you today, Andrew?
Yeah, not too bad. Just hanging out with my self-proclaimed friends, as one usually does.
I appreciate you coming on here. I hope you're doing well today. The novel that we're studying, the LaRouche case, it has a very theatrical feel to it, with a strong kind of emphasis on, you know, long periods of dialogue back and forth. Mm. And it almost reads as stage directions for actors throwing themselves about the space. I was just wondering, what's the difference between writing for a play as opposed to a novel? Like,
There's a huge difference.
Tell me about it.
So the thing about a novel is that it is read. The thing about a play is that it's watched.
Mm.
You watch a play. Like, when you're reading Shakespeare, like, I know a lot of people read Shakespeare in high school and they just don't gel with it at all. They're like, you know, I don't understand the language. I understand what's actually happening here. But when you watch Shakespeare, like, you know, maybe you read Macbeth in high school. When you watch Macbeth on stage, a lot, you can infer so much just from the actor's gestures and the use of soliloquy and their stage presence, and just what how they react to one another, and it just becomes that much more alive. Shakespeare is a particularly good example because Shakespeare was written for peasants who couldn't read. And, like, we are educated 21st century, like, laymen in many cases, but, like, point is...
We're the peasant equivalent.
Point is, we can read at least. we're smarter than a like, you know, a 16th century peasant.
One would hope.
Yeah.
Do you think a detective fiction benefits at all from this change in script writing and in tone?
Yeah, I think detective fiction actually lends itself really well to theatre.
Yeah.
Detective fiction already is sort of it's very performative in and of itself. You're always following this sort of character, this sort of kind of not omniscient, but very like sort of like outsider knowledgeable character, whether it's like Sherlock Holmes or it's Poirot or whatever, like sort of this sort of outsider character who seems to clue in very well what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of like dynamic as they're sort of going through this rogues gallery of cast of suspects just like breeds all this interesting sort of performativeness as you explore like how different people react to one another and how they operate under pressure. It's detective fiction is already quite focused on characters and it can be quite focused on dialogue because you get the interrogations and you've got all that kind of stuff and you're trying to sort of like, you know, suss out who's the villain in the story or if there even is one. You're going to get very subversive. It gels super well blending like theater elements. I mean, there are plenty of adaptations of theater of detective fiction to theater, like Sherlock Holmes Speckled Band I've seen adapted and that looked really good on stage. Poirot is like always has that kind of stuff. I mean, even when you watch like you know the Agatha Christie's Poirot like series and like ABC or whatever, it's staged in a lot of ways like a player's where it's you don't have all these big flashy set pieces. You have very very intimate close up shots a lot of characters sort of being interrogated, being grilled, and you see them reacting, and you're like, you know, maybe they're cool and calm. It's like ooh.
Love character drama portrayed through the specific kind of play directions of the author, but in this case, the director in the terms of a play, right?
Yeah, in a sense, yes. But there's also, I mean, there's two entities in a play, as I suppose there are in a film, where there's the director and the author, and they're different, they're separate entities.
Of course.
Sometimes they're the same, where someone will like write something and then direct their own work.
How do you think that when you're approaching adapting a story like that, you balance keeping true to the source material for you as the playwright and you as the director versus putting your own interpretation on it?
Well, in terms of like playwriting, like say adapting, if I was to adapt like Sherlock Holmes or something like that, I actually have written an adaptation. It was on Herbert West Reanimator, which is a H.P. Lovecraft short story. I find a common pitfall for amateur writers adapting a short story or a novel or something to play form is it becomes very reliant on monologues. Where, like, you know, take any, your average story is usually written, if it's especially written in the first person perspective, they'll just be like, this paragraph from the play, from the story, is just what they say.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the first thing that jumps to mind when I think of that is, you know, obviously we're talking about detective fiction, and the detective will walk into a room and say, "This is a clue. This is a clue. This is a clue. This is who's guilty and whatnot."
I mean, that's the interesting thing about theatre in particular is that because you've got this limited stage space, you don't have all these different sets like you do in film. You can have it, but it's for amateur theatre especially, it's a lot less manageable because you don't want to like have a whole bunch of scene changes like 5 minutes each, because then it just kills the pacing. But with a stage, like say you've got like a Sherlock Holmes detective thing, it takes place all inside this like one office, and they're investigating that maybe. And there might be a scene outside where they like have a little corner of the theatre where it's like, oh, we're out here and we're by the docks, and there's the man by the docks, or something like that. But with visual clues, you can have them all like on stage.
Yeah.
Maybe showing up at different times. Maybe there's like a gun under the desk, or like, you know, there's something, some character like, you know, sneaks in and he like, you know, he pulls a book off a like, you know, off a bookcase, and it's a secret compartment, and they walk in. But like with detective fiction, the clues are sort of being told to you. Like you sort of you pick it up in the writing and on what's being emphasized and what's being intentionally obscured. With theatre, it's much more visual.
You're talking about how each director and each playwright will make a very different product from the same kind of source material.
Yeah.
And that the strongest point of detective fiction is the puzzle, but obviously some adaptations abandon that. Do you think there's a way that abandoning the core tenets of a genre or a medium can still be wrought to work by playing with it in unique ways? And how would you maybe approach that?
I'd say yes, absolutely. The thing about genre is that you shouldn't feel constricted by it. So genre does have strictures and sort of like elements that define something as a genre, but you shouldn't feel like that you have to follow all the core tenets of that genre to be sort of true to that kind of thing. And if you understand the workings of something, you can work out how to sort of bend the rules. Like there aren't really, I mean, you can argue there are like rules to like writing a good story. But I'd say there aren't necessarily rules to writing a good story, but if there were rules, understand why you're breaking them. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So, like, obviously, like, show, don't tell is a big thing in story writing. But if you wanted to, you could write a story that's very tell, don't show, but it'd be terrible unless you had a good understanding of why you're doing that. What I like is when things get a bit subversive about that, because if you've got a character who is, like, hyper-technical and hyper-vigilant and is constantly pointing out all these flaws, like, you could easily call them out as being socially inept.
Yes.
Where it's like, it's like, yes, you are very good at pointing out all these clues and all that, but sometimes you're just a bit of a dick. Are we allowed to say dick?
We are allowed to say
Hooray.
That.
Hooray!
We're allowed to say dick?
I mean, we said Lecoq, so, you know.
I've been holding back this whole time. But, it's a brand new show.
But I know. I get kind of monologue-y and just kind of go on about some random tangent.
That's right.
But
that's
we'll get there eventually.
That's just, why we have you here.
Yeah, just put me back on track if I get back on track.
I have something even you can't get off track about that we'll see how we go. I wanted to ask, your upcoming play, The Last Temptation of Templeton, is coming out soon. Would you like to tell us a bit about how that started and maybe where we can find you that?
So, The Last Temptation of Templeton started in a dream. I'm not even joking.
Okay, good.
So, the way it started was I had a dream where I was pitching this play to everyone, to the local drama society. And in the dream, they're like, wow, that's the best play I've ever heard. And I was like, great. And then I woke up and I didn't remember anything about it.
Self-proclaimed friend of the show, yes?
Just Tenacious D's tribute in play form.
Yeah, all I remember about it was that there were three central characters, one of which was named Templeton.
Okay.
And I was like, all right, I can make a play out of that.
Cool. Yeah, and where can we find that? How do we get on that action?
So you can find Last Temptation Templeton at the Factory Theatre website. It's going to Factory Theatre, 17th to 20th of July, and the Red Rattler Theatre, 24th, 25th of July. There's also an event on Facebook, just Last Temptation of Templeton on Facebook. You'll find the event there.
Perfect.
That's a very good way to find it. But yeah, it's in terms of the actual play itself, the inception of the play is less relevant to the actual the play is actually about, and it's not really about much of anything, to be honest. It's an absurdist comedy. It's about three bogans on a porch.
And that sounds like a hard sell if ever I've heard
absolutely.
One.
I mean, yeah. Herds and I have both seen the original short version
yes,
of the play.
Yes.
What is it that is going to take that amazing absurdist dumpster fire in the best possible way and turn it into what it is now at its full length?
So I took that part one, which is mostly just them sitting around and talking. In part two, that same kind of through line of wordplay and dynamic and just like bogans being weirdly astute. follows through. But in part two, there's a bit more of actually a mystery element to it.
Oh, excellent.
In that the main character, Templeton, goes missing. And then Templeton and his two friends have to go find him.
Well, that sounds like a jolly romp.
So yeah, he goes...
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a mystery to that as all three of them are trying to work out where he's gone.
Excellent. Well, everybody, what are the two theatres again so that we can remember?
So it's the Factory Fuse Box Theatre, 17th, mm-hmm. 20th of July. Tickets on sale online now. Goodbye. and the Red Rattler Theatre, which is 24th to 25th of July.
There you go. You're listening to Death of the Reader, and that was Andrew Fallon, published playwright and the mind behind The Last Temptation of Templeton. Andrew, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you. It was a pleasure to be on board.
You're listening to Death of the Reader on 2SER. I'm Flex.
I'm Hertz.
And this is your Murder Mystery World Tour.
Yeah, imagine that we're on a blimp and we're traveling to England and then to England again and then to France and then probably back to England again and then staying there for a vacation, and that's the tour.
I mean, that sounds like a pretty realistic blimp tip trip.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good. Let's just go around Europe. Let's go. That'd be great. Oh my goodness.
So we are discussing chapters 8 to 14 of The LaRouche Case.
The best chapters.
I've only read up to chapter 14.
It's true.
Up to and including. Herds has read the lot.
Mm.
So he knows what's going on, and I have no clue, he thinks.
This is true. I know everything. I know the color of the underpants of every single character in the novel.
And is that the appendices of this book?
That's exactly correct. I can't wait for you to get them. It's a very shocking twist when that turns out to the appendices.
I see.
Flex, I have to ask.
Yes.
Who's your culprit?
It hasn't changed. Nothing's
changed.
What
do you mean? Why hasn't it changed? We've literally found all of the evidence we could ever need to convict Albert. I mean, we got the broken foil, we got the muddy boots and the torn trousers and the umbrella and the cigar. Like, it's all there. In order to set something like that up, you'd have to be some kind of crazy mastermind.
You know, I was going to make some quip about how easy it would be for Noel to do all of that, but I would not describe him as a mastermind by any stretch of the imagination.
Either. He is a good boy.
So I guess it has to be Albert. Thank you for coming,
You're
everyone.
You're welcome. It is Albert. That's what I said.
This has been Death of the Reader. There's nothing more to say.
Case closed. And I get all the points.
I think that it definitely is a bit of a trap that we walk into Albert's house and just everything is there.
Why would it be there if it's not to convict a criminal? That's what the police's job is to find evidence. So here's some hard evidence, you know? Like we were doing the Floating Admiral last week. There wasn't as much hard evidence to go on. But this week, plenty of it. It's right there. It's right in his library, in fact, right where all the knowledge is kept.
The thing I will say to that is that when all of that evidence gets found, all of his servants turn on him very quickly.
Mm.
And all of the other servants in this story have been shown to be extraordinarily loyal.
So you think that's to do with, you think they're accomplices or something?
I'm going to put that on the line. I'm going to say that they are accomplices.
Maybe they're just trying to suck up to their new master. Maybe that's all they care about, because all they care about is like staying employed.
I mean, that's plausible as well, you know? But does that not also lend itself towards the same theory anyway?
I don't think that lends itself to anything. Maybe they're just like, hey, we got a new master. We got to be like, ah, screw that other guy, because he's not noble anymore. His blood is as mud.
I don't know. But you bring up an interesting point about nobility there.
I do.
We were discussing a bit, and I was still a little confused. I do think that it was fairly clear, but I wasn't sure how exactly it was functioning.
Mm.
But I think I can confidently say that the motive for Dear Noel, who is still my culprit, is that he was trying to marry Juliet and was forbidden because of the lacking nobility of his birth.
Oh, that's so good. That's why.
I'm still not entirely sure which side of the family that's come from, because obviously Juliet's family, it basically doesn't factor into the story, as she's said to have come up a pauper.
Yeah, she was not an urchin, I suppose. She apparently did not have a father, and her mother beat her and all this sort of stuff, which is awful. She was brought up on sweetmeats and damaged fruits, which I assume means that she was poor and not fed well as a child. But yeah, she uses her looks to like get what she wants, girl. yeah, she's got to get what she wants. She's a gold digger, apparently. I don't know. It's pretty clear that Noel is head over heels for her. He'll do whatever he wants, whatever she wants, whatever he can for her. But you think that includes murder?
I don't think. I'm not saying that she's asked him to kill anyone. I'm just saying that that's why he's killed someone.
Oh, you think she wanted a little bit of, a little spice in her life, some murder?
No, that's explicitly the opposite of what I'm saying.
Okay. Just making sure we're on the same page here.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like, as I said last week, I think that this story definitely does, in the middle section, try and sway you as far away from Noel as possible after making him fairly suspicious in the first part.
He's just a good boy. He just wants to, he wants to help Albert out of prison. He wants to marry the girl of his dreams. What's more romantic than that? And really, we should be on the side of the romance here, okay? That's the
should
real...
we?
Yeah.
Miss, I don't think that it is a far cry to say that Juliet was named after one Shakespeare character you may have heard of, and thus, you know, the forbidden romance and the double suicide is probably coming at the end. I'm going to put that on the table.
I don't think so. I don't think there'll be any suicide going on.
All right.
Here.
And I also think that if the culprit was Albert, arresting him right at the start of the story seems like a strange move. And well, I don't want to say that it couldn't work.
I mean, it's pretty clear to me that Albert has gone on the murder rampage because somebody told him to.
Really? Who was that?
Yeah, well, he also has a sweetheart that he's going after. Yeah. So it's possible his lovely sweetheart, Claire, who apparently M. Deberon is also interested in. I don't know, maybe there's something going on there.
Why
maybe
is it that just every character has a relationship in this book?
That's the fun part. That's why I love this novel so much. Deberon, I'll be real.
Deberon's like the police officer, right?
He's
like
the magistrate.
What's he doing tied up with the suspects?
Well, he's tied up. Well, yeah, you're right, actually. He does try to kill Albert, which is fun. He goes to like a party
such a
or something.
Stand-up guy.
It's fantastic. That's what I love about this novel. I'm going to keep coming back to is the fact that they feel like real characters and they have relationships and they act on their motives, but they don't actually kill each other because that'd be mean. But yeah. And Deberon was in love with Claire, and then she found out that Claire thought of him as a father figure, and she actually loved Albert. And she hasn't even been on screen yet, I don't think. Oh, she, except for in that flashback. So that's fun. But yeah, I think that Albert, he's doing it out of love. That's where love comes from. That's what it all comes down to. This novel is all about romance and love and what it'll make you do.
I see.
I'm saying that Albert did the killing, but right, that perhaps Claire persuaded him to, or that the Count did. Or maybe the Count hired an assassin. There's all sorts of places we can date this.
There are all sorts of places we could take this, but none of what you've said is to the answer.
That's inappropriate.
Listen, I'm still sticking with Noel and Juliet and, you know, the servants being tied in and roped into this scheme.
It just seems funny that the Count wouldn't know what his servants are doing.
It seems funny that the Count wouldn't know what his servants are doing?
Well, what the Viscount's servants are doing. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I think that's very funny.
Even though we've just been discussing how easily they switch person to person.
No, but that's with Albert being switched. The Count, however, is a vampire, as we know. And if you betray a vampire, you get your blood sucked out of you.
I see. All right.
I'm just saying.
Interesting.
Yeah, there you go.
I'm glad that you've posited this solution, even though that's meant to be my role here.
I'm just saying, I got to posit my own solutions here. Otherwise, what's the point of me being here? What am I here for?
We haven't really dealt with many frame jobs on this show, but that's true. Reckon that this could be a thorough framing.
Oh, you think he's got some kind of plan? This
inside
no,
men,
this lovely
turning
man,
servants,
who's just worried about his poor not mother, who's dying of shock. Apparently,
is that what it is? You really think that Noel cares for his not mother?
Maybe he
after
does.
Spending multiple chapters,
he's
complaining that he's been lying to her.
He's an emotional child, all right, and he just wants his mother, not mother, to be happy, even if he doesn't admit it himself.
This makes very little sense.
It makes perfect sense.
I see.
You understand? It's about love. Don't you get it? And the familial bond. That's what it's all about. Mm. Count's got to realize that he's got to let his son be who his son is, which is not his son. And he's got to let, MJ's going to let her son, you know, not be a murderer. I will say all of your theories seem to rely on a very overly complicated plan. Do you think that's the sort of thing to expect in this novel?
Yes, is the short answer I will give.
Fair enough.
Because this was a serialized publication, what that means is that the audience would have had a bit more time to get used to everything that was happening rather than reading it all at once.
Right.
And so perhaps there's a bit more room to say that a complicated solution can work. And not to mention that framing someone is not a complex concept, even if the methods are complicated.
I guess we'll have to find out.
I guess we will. Next week on Death of the Reader, we'll be covering chapters 15 to the end of the LaRouge case, as I'm proven right, I can only assume.
Wrong.
Incorrect. Minus points. Where's my vampire when I need him?
And we'll also be letting you know the title of our next book, so be sure to tune in for that. We'll see you then. Herds, I promise that this one is at least in English.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to it.